Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At the turn of the last century, Secretary of State John Hay called the famed explorer Clarence King, quote, the best and brightest man of his generation. Only decades later did the world learn that King had secretly married a black woman with whom he had five children. And decades more passed before my guest today revealed that Clarence King led this secret double life while passing as a black man himself. Historian Martha Sandweiss joins me in the studio. Her new book is titled Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, Martha. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
And I know you prefer to be called Marnie, so I shall do that. But the name on the book is Martha Sandweiss, and it's spelled S-A-N-D-W-E-I-S-S. I am totally intrigued by Clarence King. What got you interested in him?
You know, many, many years ago, I read a wonderful biography of King while I was in graduate school. It was a 400-page book that detailed all his exploits as an explorer, as the best and brightest, as a witty writer, the most charming conversationalist in all of New York. And in those 400 pages, there were four pages that alluded to the fact that he had married an African-American woman or had a relationship with an African-American woman that had lasted for 13 years.
A relationship that produced five children.
Well, and in fact, I now know it was a common law marriage conducted by a religious minister. But this stuck in my craw, 13 years of his life, and it didn't merit a little more attention than four pages. So I've been thinking about returning to this project for a long time.
So when you returned to it, did you begin searching for photographs of both him and his wife?
Well, there are no photographs of the two of them together. Clarence King was extremely careful to make sure that he would leave behind no documentation of his secret life. But what I decided to do was to just poke around a little bit in census records. And about 5 or 10 years ago, various proprietary companies began digitizing the U.S. federal censuses. And these are extraordinary documents. And one day, sitting in my office at Amherst College, I decided to see what I could find. And I called up James Todd, which was the pseudonym that King used in his secret marriage, and I found a record of him living as a black man with his family.
Where?
In Queens, New York, in Flushing. And I decided I needed to write this book.
Oh, my. And let's describe Clarence King.
Clarence King was born in Newport, Rhode Island in 1842 to a quite distinguished American family. His great-grandfather was a senator. His grandmother was an abolitionist who was much admired by the great Frederick Douglass. His father was a China trader who died at sea when Clarence was very young, and he was really raised by his mother, who was only 16 when he was born. They were very, very close. He's well-educated. He goes off to Yale in 1860, receives the best scientific education of the day, really. And although the Civil War is raging when he gets out of Yale, he has no desire to fight. He decides to go west. And in 1863, he walks across the continent, gets out to California, meets up with the men on the California State Geological Survey, and spends a few years exploring the High Sierras. He later writes a best-selling book about this. But then, remarkably, he's barely 25 years old. In January of 1867, he comes back to Washington. He marches into the office of Secretary of War Edwin Stanton and says, I have a plan to map the West. And Stanton puts this 25-year-old boy, really, in charge of the 40th parallel expedition that would map the West. And King imagine and invents this whole structure of surveys that allowed America to sort of figure out what was out there in the years after the Civil War.
It is also of great interest to those of us here in Washington that this extraordinary man is one of the two founders of the Cosmos Club here in Washington, which of course only allowed men to be members for a very long time.
And he was the first director of the United States Geological Survey, whose headquarters are in Washington as well.
So his interests were wide, and his interest in other people was very, very intense, whether they were African, whether they were Latin. He was just interested in different races.
He was, and we might say that he had a kind of romantic fascination with women of color. When he went to Cuba, he would hang out with dark-skinned women in coffee shops and talk to them all day. When he was out in California, he liked to spend time with Indian women. When he was in Hawaii, he liked to speak to Native Hawaiian
women. How do we know all this?
His friends would record stories about this in their letters, and sometimes King even joked about it himself.
Do you believe that his wife believed he was a black man?
Actually, I do. Because King introduced himself to Ada Copeland, his future wife, as a man named James Todd, who was a Pullman porter. And you may know that Pullman porters were always black. It was a very elite black profession. And it was a brilliant lie on King's part because Pullman porters were rather worldly. And of course, King knew a lot about the world. They made a reasonable income. And of course, they were gone from home all the time.
Course.
So it covered all of these sins. But if you were a Pullman porter, you had to be black. If you wore a Pullman porter's coat, maybe King did that, you had to be black. And the key thing to understand here is this. In the late 19th century, the determination of your race in the United States of America was not based on what you looked like alone. It was also based on what people imagined about your ancestry. If you had one black great-grandparent out of eight, you could legally be defined as a black person in many southern states. So King just volunteered that he had African ancestry when he had none at all.
And he was fair-skinned and blue-eyed.
Exactly. He had a very light complexion, sandy, blondish-brown hair, blue eyes. And I sometimes think that his apparent whiteness was the best warrant that he was really a black man. Because if you looked like that, why would you volunteer to be black unless you really were?
Did anyone else know him as a black man?
Certainly people did, but there's no documentation of that. You know, he lived as a black man with his wife, Ada Copeland Todd, later Ada King, and their five children. So in their neighborhoods, perhaps within her church circles, in her circle of friends, he was known as a black man.
The book is titled Passing Strange, and it is, as Martha Sandweiss writes, a Gilded Age tale of love and deception across the color line. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Would they walk to various places together? Would they? You said they go to church together, but would they go to social events together?
It's hard to say. King was playing a very complicated double game here. His friends believed him to be the wittiest, most eligible bachelor in all of New York, and they knew nothing about his wife and his family. His wife believed him to be a black Pullman porter, so she knew nothing about his life in Midtown Manhattan. So they had to be very careful about the sorts of public spaces they appeared in New York City. I have to imagine that they were together in the areas around their homes in Brooklyn and later in Flushing, Queens. But I can't imagine they went out, say, in Midtown Manhattan together. The risk of King running into one of his friends was just too great.
Doesn't it make you wish that, as an historian, you also were a psychoanalyst?
I've really had to face up to my limits in writing this book. Number one, I'm not a novelist. If I was a novelist, I could get inside their heads and be omniscient and truly imagine what they said to each other. But I'm a historian who lives and dies by her footnotes, and I just can't go there. So I've tried to be very careful in showing my readers what I know and where I'm speculating. There's lots of footnotes in this book.
Lots of footnotes I look through.
But I'll sometimes say, perhaps they did this, or they might have believed or would have gone, to show you where I'm speculating. But I'm also not a psychobiographer. Oh, my goodness. I put what I know into this book, and the psychobiographers can go have a heyday with it.
Of course, racial passing was really something that was more than common in those days.
But racial passing of a certain sort. Many, many thousands of people of African-American descent lived as white people in late 19th century America. Because the very idea of passing involves the idea of taking on an identity that allows you to move towards greater social and political privileges. The idea of being a white person passing as black, passing, moving farther away from those privileges, is much, much rarer. We do know of people in American history who were white who lived as black people, to join a family, to evade anti-miscegenation laws, or to gain some sort of economic advantage. But I'm not aware of any other public figures who ever tried to pull this off.
Martha Santweis, her new book about Clarence King, alias James Todd, is titled Passing Strange. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org or a Twitter to drshow. Here's an email from Beth. Is Clarence King not the man who was part of the Five of Hearts that included Hay and John Adams and their wives? The number was five, I believe, and I think I remember from that book that they knew of his wife.
Not quite. This group involved Henry Adams and his wife and John Hay and his wife.
I said John Adams, forgive me.
Mm-hmm. It was five because, of course, King was the bachelor member of the group. And at the moment that this group was in full swing while King was living in Washington as director of the United States Geological Survey, King had not yet married his wife. He truly was a bachelor at this particular moment.
I see. How did people – well, let's go back a little bit. Tell us about Ada, his wife. Where was she born? What did she look like? How did they meet?
Well, Ada Copeland was born into slavery, I believe, in late December 1860, just weeks before Georgia voted to secede from the Union and Civil War subsequently broke out. She was from the area around West Point, Georgia, which is in western Georgia near the Alabama border, probably lived on a small cotton farm. It's been very difficult to find a trace of her in the historical records there. I believe I've found the family that probably owned her, but I haven't found the sort of literary or historical trace of her. But she was an extraordinary person. First of all, she's extraordinary because she learned to read and write. At the time when she was born, it was illegal for enslaved people to be allowed to read and write in the state of Georgia. She learns to read and write, perhaps in one of the Reconstruction schools there. And then in the mid-1880s, by herself, I believe, she somehow moves from far western Georgia to New York City. And this was extremely rare at this time. Very few people were moving north.
That move to the north didn't begin until a little later.
Yes, it becomes much more common around World War I.
Exactly. So where do you think the two might have met?
Well, she ends up in New York City, and we know she finds a job as a nursemaid. In all likelihood, that meant she was living in the homes of her white employers. So where could she have met King? Well, I tried to imagine that perhaps she met him in that house, but that's impossible. He would have walked in the front door. He would have been Clarence King. He would have been the friend of the family. He couldn't go back to the nursery and say, "Hi, my name is James Todd." So I've dismissed that idea. I think they have to have met in a public place. Maybe she was walking the children on the street or was in a park with them or was on a trolley. It's hard to say.
Hard to say. And yet, the year that they married is what?
1888.
He had already served as head of the U.S. Geological Survey, which is now headquartered in Reston, but at the time was here in Washington. He and John Hay, or someone else, who was the co-founder of the Cosmos Club?
You know, I'm not sure of that.
All right. But he was one of two co-founders. And it is after that that he moves to New York.
Right. At the time he meets Ada Copeland, he's really working as a mining consultant and engineer. He's really trading on his good name. And here's the thing. He had to be Clarence King in order to be James Todd. That is, he marries this woman, and they have five children in pretty short order. He can't support her as a Pullman porter. He can't support her as a working man. He has to be the famous Clarence King to go out into the world to earn the money to bring home to support his secret family.
How does he encourage her to be secretive?
That is a great question. We have reports of just a few letters that he wrote to her over the years that came to public light in a trial later in the 1930s. He sometimes is peculiar. He says, "Hide the children when my friend comes by," or "Don't talk too much to the neighbors." But basically, Ada Todd didn't know she had a secret life. She didn't know her husband had an alternative identity. She might have wondered, why did she never meet his family? Why did she not really know his friends? But I think she might have imagined her husband was passing for white in the workplace and didn't want her identity known. And it behooved her not to ask too many questions. She really had a solid middle-class life with this man.
You mentioned the trial. And this is actually how people came to learn of Clarence King and James Todd and the dual identities. It's after Clarence King dies. What happens?
When Clarence King is dying of tuberculosis in late 1901 out in Phoenix, he decides to come clean, and he writes a letter on his deathbed to his wife. And he says, "My name is not really James Todd. It's Clarence King." Astonishingly, he says, "Write this in the family Bible in case you forget it. And go ahead and change the children's names." Okay, he dies. Ada Todd, over the years, claims the name of Ada King. She changes her children's surnames to King. And every month, beginning right after her husband's death, she gets a check. And she believes it to be from the trust fund that her husband said he had established for her. As the years go on, she wants the body of that trust fund. She's a mature woman. She doesn't need to be treated like this. She hires lawyer after lawyer after lawyer. They all drop her case till finally in 1933 she gets her day in court, and she goes to court to get the body of the trust fund. In a courtroom, she reads the love letters out loud. And the press is all over this, the black press, the white press. But at that particular moment, nobody much remembered who Clarence King was. So it was a scandal, but not an enormous scandal. It turns out the judge ruled Clarence King was broke when he died. There was no trust fund he'd established for his family. And it was revealed only then that the money Ada had gotten every year for 32 years came from King's great friend, the Secretary of State of the United States, John Hay, later his widow, later their children, to keep this quiet and protect their friend's reputation.
So it was John Hay's own generosity that kept that family going.
Exactly. It was charity.
Total charity. And Clarence King was pretty much broke.
He was completely broke. He borrowed so much money from the generous John Hay in the years after his marriage. He was millions of dollars in debt to John Hay at the time he died.
Boy, talk about generosity.
Right. You know, King's friends could never figure out how he went through money so fast. But they didn't know that he was supporting the wife, the children. They lived in a large house in Flushing with servants and piano teachers and this and that, and his friends hadn't a clue.
I wonder to what extent you might have been influenced by Philip Roth's famous novel, The Human Stain.
Two things influenced me as I began to think about writing this book. One, honestly, was the Clinton scandals. Here was a public figure who had committed an indiscretion that lasted for, 30 minutes? And it was spread around the globe. And I knew about a public figure who'd lived a secret life for 13 years and no one found out about it. And about the same time, Philip Roth wrote his fantastic novel, The Human Stain, which, as you know, is about a person of African-American descent who's leading a secret and duplicitous life as a white person. And Roth gets so inside that character's head, so imagines the motivations for it. That was both an inspiration and in some ways a frustration, because not being a novelist, I couldn't do that in my case.
But there was some evidence. Tell us about some of these letters that you did find.
The letters were read out loud in this court trial in 1933, and they were recorded in the court records. They were reported by various newspaper journalists, but then the letters disappeared. So I have to say I've actually never physically seen one of these letters.
But you've seen copies of them in the court records.
Exactly.
Now, why would they have disappeared?
It's really hard to say. And I should say that there are large bodies of King papers. The Huntington Library out in California has a large collection of King correspondence, voluminous correspondence between King and Henry Adams, between King and John Hay. But nothing in those letters, trust me, ever mentions the secret life.
Now, Clarence King destroyed the letters that Ada sent to him. Mm-hmm. But did she destroy the letters? Clearly not all of them that he sent to her.
No, she gave some of them to the lawyers she thought would help her, and those disappeared. She saved still others long enough to read out loud in the courtroom in 1933, and those just disappeared sometime after the trial.
How warm, how loving were those letters?
They're extremely warm and loving. My darling, I lay awake at night. All I can think about is you. My darling, I love the letter you sent to me because you touched it with your own hand. They're very emotional letters.
And they're gone.
They're gone.
All right. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. How are you this
Fine,
morning?
Fine, thank you.
Great. Always good to hear your show.
Thank you.
I had an interesting observation here. He was a co-founder of the Cosmos Club. I believe that's up on Massachusetts.
Right. Exactly.
They didn't permit women. My recollection, I could be wrong, they didn't permit black men either. as far as I know. I mean, maybe as servants or janitors, but not as members. But the other indicator, I think, or a good indicator, his eyes were blue. And I'm saying it's not impossible for a black person to have blue eyes, but that should have triggered some type of alarm right there. I mean, the scrutiny should have been overwhelming that he was black and had blue eyes. I mean, I've never, of course, biologically, or it's not impossible, but I mean, it should have triggered an alarm. But the story in itself, I think it's just appropriate that right around St. Valentine's Day, particularly with these letters, that you hear something so warming and the stories. I mean, that someone would have to go to these extremes just for love and someone that they love. Those are my comments.
You're quite right, Eric. I certainly agree with that. At the same time, you have to wonder why this historical evidence has not been part of his story up to now. And at 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Marnie, why do you think that is?
Well, I think actually this is a wonderful example of how stories are told and not told in American history. As I mentioned before, there was a wonderful biography written about King. It was written in the 1950s by a scholar named Thurman Wilkins. And Thurman Wilkins could have gotten on the subway car and gone to interview Ada King. He just imagined she was dead. He didn't want to think about the fact that his white hero, this brilliant scientist, had actually had the secret life. But Ada King lived till 1964. She lived to be 103, and she was one of the last living Americans to have been born into slavery. But the scholars who worked on King didn't want to go find her.
Interesting. What about Eric's point about the blue eyes?
Well, I think Eric is right that many people... that some people of African-American ancestry certainly can have blue eyes. But Ada Copeland Todd King, whatever we want to call her, had no reason to imagine she was being deceived. This is a man who loved her, who asked her to marry him, who fathered her children, who supported her. I don't think she was looking for deception.
Let's go now to Lynette in Palm Coast, Florida. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. This is a wonderful program. We love your show.
Thank
you. So many
of us
listen to you. But I just wanted to, repeat what has been said a little bit earlier. It's just that it's not quite that unusual for people to be deceptive, I suppose, under those conditions and perhaps even conditions today, given the Jim Crow historical remnants that are part of who this American culture or what this American culture is. But on the other hand, it's intriguing that we have an opportunity to have some acknowledgement of something that many, many people, I'm sure, were aware of, and there are probably other instances as well, no doubt. I thank you for your research.
All right. Thanks for calling. Any comment, Marnie?
Well, I think that's a good point, because I think the case of Clarence King shows just how fluid and arbitrary racial designations have been in American history, particularly, as the caller just pointed out, during the Jim Crow era in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it's so ironic, because these laws that said one black great-grandparent was enough to make you black were supposed to make race so fixed and rigid. But ironically, they allowed a light-complexioned person like King to claim African-American ancestry when he had none at all.
Tanya Weinberg, one of our producers who has worked on this program, tells me that John Wesley Powell was the primary founder of the Cosmos Club. There is a book that profiles 60 founders of the Cosmos, and clearly Clarence King was one of them. I'm interested as to whether the Cosmos Club has invited you to speak.
Not yet, but they have an opportunity to. But can I say one other thing about the clubs, though? Because King was a great clubman. And in Manhattan, he belonged to close to a dozen different gentlemen's clubs. And this is actually a piece of how he pulled off his double life. because these gentlemen's clubs, which did not have black members, did not have women members, as the previous caller pointed out, were where he conducted his public life. He dined there, he entertained friends there, he received his mail there, he sometimes had business meetings there. And he lived in a suite of rooms at a residential hotel in Manhattan. That is, as Clarence King he did. And this was not uncommon. Many upper middle class and well-to-do New Yorkers lived in hotels because then you didn't have to hire your own servants. But since he was often in a club and in hotels, nobody would notice when he disappeared. He might be at a different club. He might not, you know, be there today.
But all those clubs cost money, Marnie. And he was just going deeper and deeper into debt.
He was so in debt to his dear friend John Hay, millions of dollars in debt to his dear friend John Hay.
Passing Strange is the title of the book. Martha Sandweiss is with me. She is the author. She's professor of history at Princeton University. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. By the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York's Finest versus Al-Qaeda. Writer Christopher Dickey takes us inside the New York City Police Department's Counterterrorism Division, a unit that taps the language skills of the city's ethnically diverse police ranks and stations cops overseas to gather intelligence. Dickey's book is called Securing the City. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Princeton historian Martha Sandweiss has written a fascinating book about a man who lived two lives, one as a very prominent white geologist, the other in his marriage as a black porter. The book is titled Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. It is clearly not uncommon, Marnie. Here's an email from Dolores, who says, Diane, it's so amazing you're covering this particular story in my own family. And she describes herself as African-American. All of my family members have always believed my great-grandfather was a white man passing as a black man, but it just seems so strange. Nobody, even his children, knew his parents or other family members, but we believe he was a white man passing as a black man passing for white.
That's fascinating. And I hope, you know, telling this story in a more public way will allow more family stories like this to come out.
What happened to King's children?
Well, Clarence King and his wife, Ada, had five children. One died as a toddler, and four grew to adulthood. In 1913, the two girls married, and they each married as white women. And they married in City Hall in Manhattan, each swearing for the other, as you had to have a witness in this day. That they were white. A few years later, their two brothers decided to volunteer for service in World War I, and they were both assigned to black Jim Crow regiments. So race continued to play out for this family in a very complicated way. Ada King raised her children, and then she raised her grandchildren. She had only one grandchild by blood. She raised that daughter in a black world. The girl was quite light complexion. She later moved into a white world, married a white man, and in the 1950s, fearful that her own African-American ancestry could make itself visible in the face of her child, she adopted children instead of having her own.
Oh, my goodness. Did she win at trial the access to monies that John Hay was actually providing, which she thought was a trust from Clarence King?
No, Ada King gambled all, and she lost. The extended Hay family continued to pay her monthly check up to and even during the trial. But the moment their name came out in trial, the moment it was revealed that there was no trust fund, those monthly checks ended.
And how did she then support herself?
Well, by that time, she's in her 70s. Her son and daughter continued to live with her all of their adult lives. So they just got by in a rather modest way.
How did you find Clarence King's great-granddaughter?
Well, I knew where the family lived in the 1930s when this trial took place, and I decided to follow the money, which is to say I decided to follow the sale of that particular house.
I see.
And by going through deeds in New York City records, I was able to figure out who the house eventually was sold by and track down the great-granddaughter in that way.
Did you talk directly with her?
I talked with her. I've met her several times. And at that moment, I hadn't been able to figure out when Ada King died. I'd looked for her death certificate and just not found one, and I gave up. I met this woman who's more or less my age, and she starts telling me stories about remembering her great-grandmother. And I said, wait a minute, how old was she? And she said, well, she lived to be 103.
Wow.
So I really treasure the help of this great-granddaughter. She has very vivid memories of being inside the family home, of her great-grandmother's sayings, of what her great-grandmother liked to read and talk about. So it's been an extraordinary thing to come that close to this historical story.
What was the great-granddaughter like?
She's a lovely person. She's very proud of her family. She didn't know, I think, too much about Clarence King. She told me that her grandmother had an Encyclopedia Britannica in her house that had the Clarence King's entry marked. But Clarence King had died when his own children were very young. They were all under 10. So the great-granddaughter's great aunt and uncle, whom she knew very well, really didn't even have stories of their father to pass on.
All right. Let's go now to Matt in Atlantic Beach, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. Thank you for your wonderful show.
Thank you.
Actually, I had two questions, and you pretty much answered them both.
Oh, good.
Concerning her... the children and what happened to them and if they're still around and aware and so forth, you know, of what their history is.
Well, now, hold on a minute, Matt. Are any of the children themselves alive today?
Well, no, but I mean, you know, the subsequent, descendants.
Right. Any of the grandchildren alive today?
No, the only descendant alive today is the great-grandchild.
Is the great-granddaughter.
But the children lived until 1981, I believe.
Uh-huh.
It's a very long-lived family.
Yeah,
there.
Good. And your your other question, Matt?
Was also about how she supported herself after the trial. I was curious about that, and you already mentioned that she just did what she had to do. She was already 70, and she lost her monthly income, and she lasted till 103, and I just wondered how she was able to survive. And I thought maybe it had something to do with her children, might have helped or gotten into something lucrative, but I was just very curious about that end of it.
All right, Matt, thanks for calling. And again, did those children help to support their mother after he, after John Hay and the family cut off the monthly check?
Absolutely. This was a very, very close family. And as I said, the two surviving children live with their mother all their adult lives.
Did not marry themselves?
One of them did marry, and her husband lived in the house with them as well.
I see. All right. Let's go to Anthony in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, Diane. It's really an honor to be on the show.
Oh, thanks.
I had a curiosity about King, who was living this duplicitous life, and he was surrounded by basically all these upper-class white scientists and possibly politicians and high culture. And he went to all these gentlemen's clubs, and he had a very social life, I guess, among these people. Was there any pressure or any evidence of possibly him being led to get into relationships with any white women in that environment? And if not, then what was his story? I mean, you know, if he's always hanging out with these people, I would imagine that they'd wonder, well, does this man have any relationships? Does he even like women? Also, a second question was just, how did he get his Pullman jacket?
Yeah, good question, Marnie.
Well, let me start with your question about women in his white world. As I said, he was considered the most eligible bachelor in all of New York, and his closest friends, including John Hay, were always trying to set him up with women at dinner parties. But they quickly realized that King really didn't like these women. King was very disparaging of white women. He was really attracted to women of color. And I'll let the psychobiographers run with that one. Your question about the Pullman porter's coat, I don't know for certain that he had a coat, but I think he would have had to have had a coat to pull off this complicated conceit. And Clarence King was a man who could charm a coat off of anyone. I don't think he would have trouble finding one.
You know, there are some wonderful photographs in this book, but the first is of a youthful Clarence King dressed as a woman on the photographic calling cards he made up to distribute to his friends. What do you make of this?
Well, I'd like to imagine that it comes from some sort of dramatic production that he was in.
Or a joke.
Or a joke. Yeah. I'm going to let the psychobiographers run with that one, Diane.
But, you know, what it reminded me of was the New York Times Magazine article published many, many years ago on Ernest Hemingway, showing him and a book that subsequently came out on Hemingway, showing him as a toddler dressed as a young girl, which apparently his mother did for 5 years. This man who turned out to be the kind of male of all males spent 5 years dressed as a little girl. But here are photographs of Clarence King, some elegant, some on location with his work as a geologist, as a mapper. And then one photograph in a green velvet suit as he raced around Spain in 1882, searching for a barber's basin like the one Don Quixote had worn. He purchased the basin for a friend and wrote an account of his search in The Helmet of Mambrino, an essay published by his friends and in the memorial volume issued after his death. And in those writings, I gather he talks not one whit about being married.
No. King never says a word about being married. And, you know, he was a very gifted writer. I'm glad you brought that up. And when he died, his friends said, how could he have so much talent and have written so little? But I like to imagine that King's greatest story was the one he spun out for his wife, and that his literary talents were expended in a Flushing drawing room instead of in the pages of Century Magazine.
There is also a formal studio portrait of the younger Ada King, Clarence and Ada's daughter. She's very light-skinned. And later on, another photograph of her, which appeared on the front page of the New York Daily News on November 15, 1929, after the drive-by shooting of her companion, John Ancona. Now, was he black or was he white?
He was white and he was Italian.
Why was he shot?
I think he got swept up in some kind of gangland shooting, and she just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Whoa, what a story, I'm telling you. All right, and there's another email from Sonia in Baltimore who says, I am a dark-complected African-American with blue eyes. So, indeed, it does happen. Let's go to Poncha Springs, Colorado. Good morning, Margaret. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. What a privilege to be on the air with you.
Well, it's a delight to have you. Thank you.
My great-great-grandfather was one of Clarence King's best friends, and they surveyed together on the 40th parallel.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I wondered if Martha knew of James Terry Gardner. I believe there were letters sent back and forth between them indicating that he knew of this relationship. And one of my relatives was at that trial testifying for Clarence King, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wondered if she knew of James Terry Gardner and if these letters were used at the trial.
Marnie.
Margaret, it's great to hear from you. Yes, your great-great-grandfather plays a very important role in the book. James Terry Gardner was one of King's closest boyhood friends. And I do believe he's the only person that King confided in about the secret relationship during his lifetime.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So, Margaret, I gather that that would have become the stuff of knowledge within your family and perhaps even conversation about Clarence King.
Yes, my father, who is 92 now, and his mother, of course, was the daughter of James Terry Gardner, mentioned it in several conversations that I actually heard. And there were discussions about this secret relationship and that our family was drawn into it. And I guess at that time they didn't appreciate it because I think there was just this big question of money and what was this implicating for his friends and family at that time in the 30s.
Right. The Gardner family really did get dragged into it after King's death. Ada went to James Terry Gardner and said, you've got to help me out. James Gardner himself was not an especially wealthy man. And he is the one who went to John Hay, informed John Hay about this problem. And the very wealthy, very generous John Hay took responsibility for providing the money for the King family support, often funneling the money through your great-grandfather, James Gardner.
Oh, my.
No kidding. Oh, I didn't realize it was that close a connection. That's incredible. Yeah. Well, I'll have to read your book.
I think you will.
I think so, too. And, yeah. Margaret, you've added so much depth to our understanding of this story. I wonder why Clarence King confided. Why did he choose to confide in your great-grandfather, do you suppose?
Are you asking me? Or
I am. I'm asking you.
Oh, you're asking me?
Yes.
I think because they spent so much time together in the wilderness. They were the first two to survey Yosemite. I mean, they must have had extraordinary personal and solitary experiences together. And however, he did meet, it sounds like, and marry this woman after all of this surveying took place. But they obviously bonded and formed a very close relationship.
Margaret, your comments illustrate just perfectly how I've always said that the callers to this program add so much interest. Thank you so much for being a part of the program, Margaret, and adding your own personal recollections to this new book, A Fascinating History. It's titled Passing Strange, A Gilded Age Tale of Love and Deception Across the Color Line. The author is Princeton University historian Martha Sandweiss. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks to all of you for listening and being part of the program. I'm Diane Rehm.